Good evening. My name's Dean. I'm an addict. And Nikki, a beautiful chair. Really beautiful. How do you follow that? You know, I know Nikki. And if you want any proof about this program that it works, that's it. You know, we don't shoot our wounded, you know. The door's never shut on you, do you know what I mean? And, but it's not a revolving door. Sometimes people don't get back, and that's the sad part about it, you know. And if you stay in recovery long enough, you will go to funerals, you know. Some people die clean, some people go out there and use and that, you know. There's no guarantees in this, you know. It's a day at a time. Sometimes it's an hour at a time. Sometimes it's a minute at a time, you know. And I don't take credit for my recovery. You know, my credit goes to Narcotics Anonymous and God. That's it for me and that, you know. And they say, God works with people who believe in God. God works with people who don't believe in God. But God don't work for people who think they're God, you know. And I can use the word God, you know, very comfortably in my life today and that, you know, and give her a dignity, you know, gift of desperation, whatever you want to choose, you know, and it's really, really an honour to share an NA meeting. It really, really is an honour, you know, and I haven't got the most spectacular chair in the world, you know. I haven't got the chair that will make your hair stand up in the back of your necks, you know. That's not a requirement, you know. My requirement is that, you know, it didn't matter what drugs I use. It was my inabilities to stop using drugs once I started. That's my qualification. Because whatever I picked up, I could not stop using, you know. No human power could relieve me from my addiction, you know. And God could and would if I sought, you know. And everything I'm talking and saying tonight, it's been given to me secondhand, you know. You're not going to hear anything unique off me, you know, or mind-blowing. You know, the mind-blowing thing is that I've stayed clean. That's the mind-blowing thing for me, and that, you know. And for me, you can come into the program and you can stop using and you don't have to work the steps. You don't have to have a sponsor. You don't have to have God. If you choose to have it that way, then that's fine. That doesn't work for this addict, you know. I've tried playing God in my life. It doesn't work. I ended up in handcuffs in recovery, so I wouldn't suggest that. I follow a suggested program of recovery. It's a 12-step program, and I follow the 12-step program, you know. It's not perfect anonymous, you know. You don't have to be perfect in there, you know. What you need is just a bit of willingness. You know, that's my experience. You know, I'll give you a bit of identification where I come from. I was born in 1958, and my mum was an addict. My dad was very, very violent. And when I was a young child, my mum ran away from my dad. We were on the run from it, you know. And what would happen was, when I did see my dad, I could never tell him where I actually lived, you know. So all my life was quite a secret, you know. And when I was 7 years old, I went to live with my grandmother, who was a schizophrenic. And my mum had four kids, and my brother was in care. My other sister was given away, and my other sister wasn't born, actually. And my mum, this is not about to disrespect my mum, but it's the reality. You know, my mum was, she really shouldn't have had children, do you know what I mean? And, but she's done the best she could do with all she had, and that, you know, and knowing that she's an addict, you know, and my nan hated my dad because my dad beat my mum and that, and I looked like my dad, really, really the image of my dad. And she would torture me, my nan, you know, and it was a painful childhood, you know, to the extent that she tried to murder me. And when I told my mum what was going on in my life, I was told, shh, don't say nothing. And I realised today my mum, you know, she'd already lost two of her children, you know, and she was trying to keep me, and she done the best she could do, you know. And eventually they got me out of the house. And as soon as I got out of that house, I went on the street, and I loved it. You know, consequences were, when you're a young child on the street with no direction, is I got taken away, abducted, sexually assaulted. I just thought all this behaviour was just normal. And I actually thought it's because who I am, that's why they're doing it to me. You know, that I didn't really understand. Do you understand? You know. But nobody ever forced drugs on me. Let's have it right, you know. Nobody ever, you know, opened my mouth and put it down me, you know. I took drugs because I like to change the way I feel. That's the reality and that. And the first addiction I was into was fantasy, you know. When I was at school, they said to me, what do you want to do when you leave school, Dean? I said, I want to be the Artful Dodger. Because the Artful Dodger was free, you know. He never had any ties, you know, and I aspired to hanging around with gangs. That was my childhood, you know. I come from London, and you either join the gang or you become, you know, the prey. So I just joined the gang. And I used them people in the gang as such, as my elders, you know, and you take a few beatings now and again. But they were like my family and that, you know. And I don't want to disrespect anybody here, but my trust in women were really, really not good, you know. And today that's totally different, you know. I have lots of women friends, you know, and I'm really lucky. But anyway, I picked up when I was 11. I picked up solvents, I picked up alcohol, and I didn't like alcohol. Alcohol made me feel absolutely sick. It didn't stop me drinking it, mind you, I just have it right. And I picked up solvents, and then I picked up, you know, because again, when I was young, there wasn't the drugs that we were now. You know, there wasn't many choices, you know, Chernal, you know, Speed, you know, Diazepam, Mogadons, you know, they were the stuff that you could get. And of course there was heroin, you know. My choice of drugs really was benzos, you know, and codeine. They were my choice of drugs and that, because that's all I really had. And Nikki talked about the paranoia, not to cross yet, but that's really, really what really was the worst part for me, you know, the sleep deprivation, you know, and the extreme, you know, the days of going on end without no sleep. And it had me. And I remember I was in a squat, and the fella said, do you want a hit? Get some heroin. And I said, well, why not, you know? And the fella got the works out anyway. He's just about to eject me. My mate that was with me said to me, if you touch that, I'm going to smash your head in. And he could, you know, he was a bit handy. And I didn't take it that night. And I think what happened was that man saved my life indirectly. Because after that, it was a course of events that I actually just lost all my friends. They all got into the smack and OD'd, you know. And by the time I was 23, you know, I was absolutely finished, you know. So I just changed my substance, you know. I just changed the substance, and that's what I would do. And that's all my using. It was changing substances to suit, you know, the situation or where I was. I heard somebody say the other day, you know, I had different sort of friends for different sort of things, you know. What I really liked, I liked my hippie friends because they were really laid back in that, you know. And then I had the friends that would go out clubbing, and of course then there was the gangs, you know. And I absolutely hated violence, absolutely hated violence. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't drink that very much, because that's what I equated with alcohol and that, you know. And everything was all right when I was younger as such, because I didn't have any responsibilities. It wasn't until I was about 24 and I met my partner and I had my first son. And that's when really my addiction kicked in, because that's when I had to start being an adult. And my, you know, if you start using it at 11, you know, you don't emotionally grow. That's it for me anyway. I didn't anyway, you know. And my inability to take responsibility. In fact, the more responsibilities I had, the more I used in that, you know. And I've had psychotherapy, psychiatrists, you name it, I've had it. And that, you know. And and I went to this treatment centre on the 15th of June. And they said, look, we want to keep you in here. You've got to go out for a couple of days. And I went, you're all right. And when I come out of there, I thought, you know what? Something's got to change here. And I phoned up the fellowship and they said, there's a meeting tonight in Balham. And I thought, it's now 10 o'clock in the morning and I hadn't used. And I thought, I've got to use. So I thought, but I'm going to go, whatever. So I went out and I used that day. And I used probably the heaviest I've ever used and nothing happened. It just stopped working. I don't know why it just stopped working. It didn't do what it said for me, you know. And I went to this meeting and I was really, really lucky. The first person I heard share was a woman. And she didn't share the ego. She shared how she felt. And as soon as she shared how she felt, I knew I was in the right place. And that was on the 15th of June, 2005, you know. And I haven't used since my first meeting, you know. And I have to say that because it's possible to come to a first meeting and not use again. But it's also possible that you do use a lot of times and come back to the fellowship. That's the most important part. You know, if people didn't use, you probably wouldn't be a fellowship. So, you know, let's have it right. But that isn't my experience. My experience is I stayed clean and in 2 weeks' time, I'll be 16 years clean. Do you know what I mean? Day at a time and that, you know. But I'm not there yet. I still got to keep it one day at a time. You know, it's 15 years and so many days, one day at a time. You know, I can't dine out on yesterday's dinner. You know, and I came in and I got a sponsor. The first sponsor I met him at, in a bookies and he was kicking the machine and all that. Then I see him in a meeting, I thought, oh, well, he's like me, so he'll do. And he gave me the most important thing you can give another human being. He gave me his time and that, you know. And he was really armed with the facts, you know, and, you know, he was about 10 years clean then. And I put him on a pedestal. You know, I made him my higher power. And then about 3 years later, he went to live in Scotland. And I thought, you know what? I don't really need a sponsor anymore because I sort of know it all. Do you know what I mean? And I could regurgitate stuff I heard. And, you know, I was like Mr. NA, do you know what I mean? You know, and but I was lying to myself. You know, I was still the same person. But I just got a little bit of knowledge around it. Do you know what I mean? And the best thing I could do in recovery is I thought, well, look, I'm not using. I'll just start stealing, yeah? So I embarked on a life of crime. And it doesn't matter what, I'm not trying to, you know, say I'm a gangster or nothing like that, because I wasn't a gangster, nothing like that, you know. But I came in a horse thief, and I was still a horse thief. And I thought I could just pick it up and put it down, just like I do, you know, but I couldn't. And what happened was, I ended up getting nicked in recovery, you know, doing spiritual chairs, and then getting on my phone and talking to people and you know, having it away. And it wasn't until the last time I got nicked, I was sitting in this cell and I thought, I'm going to use, you know. And I walked out and I went to a meeting that night and the guy that sat in that chair, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said to me, yeah. He said, didn't get any conditions. He just said, yes. And I've been with him for, oh, I don't know, 10 years now, something like that and that. He's just another addict. And the guy that was my sponsor, my original sponsor, he picked up after 22 years. Yeah. So he's not a higher power. And that's why for me, I have to have a God of my understanding. No human being, no human power can relieve me from my addiction. And I embarked on a program of recovery, you know. And at that time, I was in a really bad way. And I met somebody called Mick the Buddha. Anyway, he said to me, how's your head? I said, it's all over the place. He said, well, meet me in Victoria tomorrow. So I said, okay. So he met me in Victoria. We went to this big house. Well, what's going on here? Anyway, we walked into this big house and we opened this door and it was a Zendo, you know, which is a Buddhist prayer room. I thought, oh, what's going on here? So he said, sit down. So I said, all right. So I sat down and this woman walked in. She had bald head, all in black. And her name was Venerable Myokan, and she was a Zen nun. And we sat there and done some meditation. And then she started talking to me. And intuitively, I just knew that I was going to be a Buddhist, you know, and I become a Buddhist there and then. you know. So one minute I was a thief, next minute I was a Buddhist. But I didn't use, and that was the most important part about it, you know. And if I don't use, I have the ability to do anything, and that, you know. And just to prove that I was a bit more a Buddhist than anybody else, like I would do, after 2 weeks, I had my whole back tattooed with a Buddha, just to prove I was a bit more Buddhist than anybody else. So I'm a very, very extreme person, you know, and, you know, and as I say, you know, it's just the way it was. And what he'd done, it gave me discipline, you know. Now, practicing Buddhism really helped me, yeah, but it won't keep me clean. It's part of my recovery. Working the 12 steps helps make me change. You know, the traditions keep us as a fellowship together, and the steps change me as a person, you know. And they gave me the tools to deal with life on life's terms without using, you know. And I'm powerless over drugs, you know. My life becomes unmanageable. I'm powerless over people, places and things today, and my life becomes unmanageable, you know. Step one is the only one you have to get right, because there's nothing to precede step one. Step one is the admitting steps, you know. If you come to a meeting, and if you're on a meeting tonight, you're doing step one. You're admitting you are powerless and you're an addict. You're admitting that because you wouldn't be on here, you know. And step two, I came to believe in a power greater than me called Restore Me with Sanity. Well, a power greater than me isn't me, obviously, because I couldn't stop using. So I took a power of my understanding, which is God, and to restore to sanity. So I don't steal today, you know. I try to be the best person I can today. You know, stealing in recovery for me is insanity, you know, because it's what's going to take me out. And that's where my addiction lives. And step three, I handed my life and my will over to the care of God as I understood God. I made a decision. I'm either all in or all out. So either God is or God isn't. So for me, God is, you know. And step four, I made a fearless more infantry. I looked at all the resentments I had in my life, you know. And the reason I could do that step forward because I had faith, which I had from step three. And I wrote down the resentments in four columns. First time I wrote down all the people, places, and institutions that I was resentful at. Then I wrote down the resentment. And resentment for me is to replay old hurts over and over again. They get bigger and bigger and bigger. I had to right size them, I had to write them down. And in the third column, it asked me, how did it affect me? How did this resentment, my securities, you know, my relationships, you know, and fear. And then it asked me, you know, where was I self-seeking, self-centered, fearful and dishonest? Now, what part did I have to play in them resentments, you know? And in step five, I shared that with God and with sponsor. You know, I shared my step five, who I really was. And at the end of it, I came out and I knew who I was. I knew all my shortcomings. And six and seven is, you know, I humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings from me. I'm aware of them because the shortcomings are what's going to take me out. But don't forget, I don't want to be perfect. I'm still a human being and I'm not going to get it right. Step eight, I took from my step four. All the people on the first column of step four, I became ready to make amends to. I had to look at what would I feel like if it was done to me. I had to feel it. I had to really, really feel it. You know, I had to feel what I'd done to other people, taking their peace of mind. And in step nine, I made direct amends to such people as not to hurt them. And I'd done all my amends except for one, and it was my sister. And I thought, I don't like her anyway, so I'm not going to say sorry to her. Well, what happened was, my mum and my sister lived together, and my mum died, and my sister never told me, and I got a letter saying that your mum's dead. I'll never forget it, it was 6 weeks after she died, and I remember getting this letter, and the pain was excruciating. And somebody gave me a reading, and it said, it's about a woman that had a resentment against her mum, and she fed it and nurtured it as she would do a child, and she knew she never got rid of the resentment that she would use. And on the way to church, she picked up the magazine. And on that cover of the magazine, it was written by a clergyman. It said, if you have a resentment against a person, place, or a thing, to pray for that person, place, or a thing as you would do yourself. Pray for their love, pray for the goodwill. And I remember that reading, and it was in my mind. And I went to church, and I prayed for my sister. And in time, Nikki talked about it, I was able to see the truth of what I was like as a son. I wasn't a brilliant son. And also, hatred doesn't cease by hatred. Hatred only ceases by love. So I had to try to turn the hatred into love and compassion for my sister, and that, you know, because she hasn't got a program, don't forget. I have, you know, acknowledged. And yeah, so I tried to make amends to my sister and she didn't want it, but you know, I tried. And that, and step 10, you know, to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. You know, my day starts with prayer, meditation. I chant the Heart Sutra. I do some readings and I write a gratitude list every morning. And I send it out to quite a few people. And I don't send it out to get one back. I just send it out because that's what I do. And if I write a gratitude list and I give myself time in the morning, I'm less prone to have resentments and to get myself into trouble. I'm less prone to it, you know. Step 11, sort through prayer and meditation. You're trying to improve my conscious contact with God as I understood him, praying for the knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. But when I come out, I didn't have a power greater than me. And today I do, you know. And if you want to talk to God, pray. If you want to listen to God, meditate. You know, meditate whatever way you want to. There's no right or there's no wrong way, you know. Just being in the moment. If I'm in the moment, then I'm not thinking about the past and I'm not projecting in the future. I'm just keeping it in the moment. You know, and all this stuff sounds really, really easy. It's very, very difficult, you know, and I get it wrong a lot of times, you know. But what I haven't got wrong one day at a time is that I've kept clean. You know, and step 12, you know, having had a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening is a change of thinking, sufficient enough to keep me clean one day at a time, you know, to carry the message to still suffering addicts and to practice the principles, honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. They are the principles of recovery. If I keep in that, just in three things, I'm halfway there, you know. I'd like to say my recovery, you know, is really, really good. I have two sons who are addicts. One of my sons on an attempted murder charge, and my other son is on a robbery charge, you know. And that's what you call powerless, you know. And I may be the only example of Narcotics Anonymous to ever see. Do you know what I mean? My son went to his drug worker yesterday, which is really, really good. Do you know what I mean? And that it's been quite painful. But I have a sponsor who's another recovering addict. I have the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. I do service, I sponsor people. My sponsor has a sponsor. And just to finish on this, I have an amazing life. I've met Bex out in Croatia, I've seen Nicky on the dance floor. When I was 60, I became a DJ, you know. You're never too old or never too young to be in the fellowship, and you're never too old or never too young to change. You know, if I don't use, I can do anything, but I just don't have to pick up one day at a time and that, you know. And I'm in, you know, I can't pay back what I've been given. And the only way I can give back is by giving my time to somebody else and that, you know. And I'd just like to send love and light to all of you. And thanks for letting me share tonight. Cheers.